Welcome back to the Deep Drive. Our job here is to take stacks of source material articles, historical research, scholarly critiques, and really just pull out the critical knowledge you need to be well-informed.
And today, we're doing just that. We're diving into one of the most significant, and I'd say contentious, religious texts to come out of 19th century America, the Book of Abraham.
Right, the Boé. And we need to be really clear about our mission here. A lot of the debate you hear about this book, it focuses on the physical papyrus fragments, the facsimiles.
All the external stuff.
Exactly. Right. We're setting all of that aside for today. We are only interested in the text itself.
That's the key. Our approach is, for lack of a better word, forensic. We're treating the Book of Abraham as a standalone document. In English, and we're looking for fingerprints.
Fingerprints.
Yeah, you know, those little internal clues, the phrasing, the anachronisms, the things that can betray when a document was really written and by whom.
And that's where the core claim comes in. Joseph Smith was unambiguous. He said this was written by his own hand upon papyrus.
Meaning it has to reflect the world of Abraham. We're talking circa 1800 BCE. Linguistically, historically, everything.
But if we find that the text is, well, riddled with 19th century ideas, specific jargon from Joseph Smith's time, and depends on sources he was reading,
then that claim of an ancient divine translation is fundamentally challenged. It's as simple as that.
Okay, so let's jump in. And I think the place to start is what you called the foundational problem. The text's reliance on things that just didn't exist in Abraham's time.
Right. It's the most basic, but also the most overwhelming piece of evidence.
So when you actually read the Book of Abraham, I mean, chapters 2, 4, and 5 in particular, you're not just seeing parallels to the Book of Genesis.
No, not at all. It's much more than that. It's a retelling in many places. It's almost a copy-paste of the phrasing and the structure from the King James Version of the Bible.
Covering the creation in Genesis 1 and 2, and then Abraham's early life from Genesis 11 and 12.
And the problem there is the timeline. It's just, it's impossible. Abraham, we think, lived around 1800 BCE. So if he's writing his own autobiography, how is he borrowing from a text, Genesis, that wasn't even compiled for another 1,000 years? At least.
So Genesis itself is post-Abraham.
Way post-Abraham. Biblical scholarship is very clear on this. The material in Genesis was gathered, it was edited, redacted is the technical term, much, much later. We're talking around the 6th, maybe 5th centuries BCE.
So a millennium after Abraham was dead.
At the earliest, yeah. So for Abraham to be writing his own story using the vocabulary and structure of a final form text that won't exist for 1,200 years, that's the first huge anachronism.
But it's not just the compilation date, right? It's the language itself.
That's the other layer to this. The language in Genesis, which the Book of Abraham mirrors in chapters 4 and 5, it's based on Hebrew.
But Hebrew wasn't a written language back in 1800 BCE.
Not in any codified literary sense. I mean, Proto-Semitic languages were evolving, of course. But the idea of Abraham writing this cohesive, complex narrative in a style that perfectly aligns with a text compiled centuries later in a language that was still, you know, developing. It just creates this immediate, unresolvable chronological mess.
Okay, that's a powerful starting point. But let's go a level deeper into a more advanced critique, the documentary hypothesis.
Yes, this is absolutely critical. For anyone listening who isn't familiar, the documentary hypothesis is basically the consensus view among scholars that the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch,
Genesis, Exodus,
right, they weren't written by a single person like Moses. They were woven together, compiled by later scribes from several different older source documents.
And sometimes these sources contradicted each other.
Exactly. The most famous ones are the J source, or the Yahwist source, and the P, the priestly source. And when the final editor, the redactor, stitched them together, they left seams, contradictions.
And there's a perfect example of this right in Abraham's own story in Genesis.
A perfect example. If you look at Genesis 11 and 12, you see it clearly. Genesis 11, which scholars say is mostly from that later priestly source, says that Abram leaves Ur with his father, Terah. They're heading for Canaan together. Terah's in charge.
Okay. Seems straightforward.
But then the very next chapter, Genesis 12, which comes from the older J source, starts with God commanding Abram to leave his country, his family, and this is the key part, his father's house.
Wait, so one says he leaves with his father, the other says he's commanded to leave his father's house.
It's a clear contradiction. One is a family migration led by the patriarch. The other is a divine command for Abram to break away from his family. The ancient redactor just put both traditions side by side. They didn't try to fix it.
And what does the Book of Abraham do with this.
This is the tell. This is the fingerprint. The Book of Abraham in chapter 2 does the exact opposite. It smooths it over. It creates one single harmonious first-person story from Abraham.
How does it do that?
Abraham basically says, I was seeking the Lord, God told me to leave, and so my father and I packed up and left. It flawlessly integrates the two conflicting accounts into one smooth narrative.
Which Abraham himself couldn't have done.
He couldn't have. Because he wouldn't have had two different contradictory historical sources written hundreds of years in his future to harmonize.
So the author of the Book of Abraham isn't working with Abraham's original story.
No. They're working with the final, stitched-together, contradictory King James Bible that Joseph Smith had on his desk. The act of smoothing out those known contradictions is the work of a later author trying to create a perfect, divinely inspired story. It's an unmistakable fingerprint of someone like Joseph Smith.
That's a really sharp point. And this reliance on later redacted texts, it continues with the global flood, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Book of Abraham's entire backstory for Egypt is based on a literal historical global flood.
What does it say exactly?
In Abraham chapter 1, it says Egypt was first discovered by a woman who was a daughter of Ham. When this woman discovered the land, it was underwater.
So it's explicitly tying the founding of Egypt to the world after Noah's flood.
Directly. But we know from geology, from archaeology, from basically every relevant science, that there was no historical global flood on that scale in recent human history.
So the entire premise is flawed from the start.
The entire premise is based on a literalistic reading of Genesis that was, you know, very common in the 19th century, but is just completely at odds with modern science. An ancient author, someone living in that region, would have had a very different story for the origin of a powerful kingdom like Egypt.
It just keeps coming back to the 19th century. So the text is importing these large-scale narrative errors from later biblical sources. Let's get even more specific now. Let's talk about specific words. Anachronisms.
Time travel in the text, yeah.
And we can start with the very first line. Abraham 1, verse 1. In the land of the Chaldeans. That phrase right there, Ur of the Chaldees.
That one phrase is probably the single most definitive linguistic fingerprint in the whole book.
Why is it such a big deal?
Okay, so Chaldeans, or Chaldea, it's a specific Semitic-speaking country. They only rose to power and controlled Mesopotamia, including the city of Ur, during a very specific and very late period.
The Neo-Babylonian period.
Exactly. We're talking 626 to 539 BCE.
So let me get this straight. Abraham, who we place around 1800 BCE,
yep,
is describing his homeland using a political name that won't exist for 1,200 years.
It's the perfect analogy someone once used. It's like having Christopher Columbus write in his journal that he landed in the United States. It's impossible.
A hard chronological postmark on the document.
It is. The phrase Ur of the Chaldees could only have come from a text written during or after that Neo-Babylonian period, which, again, is exactly when scholars believe the Genesis material was being compiled. Even staunch LDS defenders, like the group Fair Mormon, have had to concede that the term is probably anachronistic.
Wow. For the very first historical detail in the book, that's a huge admission.
It's a massive problem right out of the gate.
Okay, so if that's the postmark, what's another one? I'm thinking of Potiphar's Hill.
Ah, yes. Potiphar. This one is a fascinating deep dive into Egyptian linguistics, and we have to credit the late Dr. Robert Rittner, a top Egyptologist, for this.
What did he find?
He looked at the name Potiphar itself. It's an Egyptian name. It means the one whom Re has given. But the key isn't the meaning. It's the grammatical structure.
The way the name is built?
Precisely. The specific way those elements are arranged to form a personal name. The grammatical construction simply was not possible and was not used in Egypt until around 700 BCE.
So wait, it's not just that the name wasn't used yet. The linguistic rules to even create that name didn't exist for 1,000 years after Abraham.
That's the gravity of it. The grammar itself dates the name. We see the name in the Bible, of course, in the story of Joseph.
Potiphar buys Joseph as a slave.
Right. And this linguistic evidence dates both the biblical Exodus account and the Book of Abraham's use of the name to no earlier than 700 BCE. The author of the Book of Abraham just grabbed a familiar name from the Bible, completely unaware that the name itself was a linguistic time bomb.
And we see a similar, maybe less complex issue with the title Pharaoh, don't we?
We do. It's a two-part problem. First, the term Pharaoh, which means great house, wasn't even used as a title for the king until the New Kingdom, around 1550 BCE. So it's already anachronistic for Abraham's time.
But there's a deeper mistake being made.
A much more revealing mistake, yeah.
Yeah.
Joseph Smith uses it as if it's a personal name, like, Pharaoh did this, Pharaoh said that.
It would be like reading a history book that says President Lincoln and thinking the man's first name was President.
That's the perfect analogy. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding of ancient Egyptian customs. It proves the author's knowledge came from the King James Bible, which can be ambiguous about it, not from an authentic ancient source. It dates the author's knowledge base firmly to a time before modern Egyptology.
And this pattern of pulling in later biblical ideas continues. What about the Urim and Thummim?
Ah, the Urim and Thummim. In Abraham chapter 3, Abraham says God gave him this device to receive revelation.
And this seems to serve a very clear 19th century purpose.
Oh, a transparent purpose. It's there to back project Joseph Smith's own practices with his seer stones onto an ancient prophet to give his own methods credibility.
But historically, it's completely out of place.
Completely. First, the device doesn't show up in the Bible until Exodus, centuries after Abraham. But more importantly, there's the function. In the Bible, the Urim and Thummim was basically a divine lottery. The high priest used it to get a simple yes or no answer to a specific question.
It wasn't a crystal ball for seeing grand cosmological visions.
Exactly. It wasn't a spiritual telescope for receiving complex narratives about the creation and astronomy, which is how the Book of Abraham describes it. The text not only puts the device in the wrong time period, it completely reinvents its function to match the author's Joseph Smith's own contemporary practices.
It's an anachronism of both technology and practice.
It really is. The text is being shaped to fit the needs of its 19th century author.
Which brings us to what might be the most telling anachronism of all. The one that ties the text directly to the social and political climate of early America.
The curse of Ham.
The curse of Ham and 19th century racism.
This one is, well, it's the smoking gun, if there is one. Abraham chapter 1 states that a dark-skinned lineage descended from Ham and Egyptus preserved the curse in the land.
And crucially, that because of this curse, they could not hold the right of the priesthood.
And that idea, that specific theological justification, that wasn't some ancient Egyptian belief. That was a central burning issue in 19th century America.
It was the justification for slavery.
Absolutely. The idea that blackness was a sign of a divine curse, which therefore justified denying people religious authority and by extension their freedom and humanity, that was the air Joseph Smith breathed. That was the debate happening all around him.
So to find the exact contemporary racially charged justification for a priesthood ban written into a text from 4,000 years ago.
It's an unmistakable fingerprint. Abraham in 1800 BCE would have had no context and no reason to articulate a racial priesthood hierarchy. Joseph Smith in 1835 America had every reason to. The text isn't reflecting ancient theology. It's reflecting 19th century American racial ideology.
The book is just saturated with its author's time and place. Let's move into our third section and look at some even more specific fingerprints, direct literary borrowings.
Okay, moving from the general environment to specific documents.
And the first one is almost forensic in its precision. The link between Abraham 1, verse 2, and a patriarchal blessing from 1834.
This is a stunning parallel. We're talking about the second verse of the entire book. Abraham says he's seeking the blessings of the fathers, the rites whereunto I should be ordained, wanting to be a follower of righteousness and to have greater knowledge.
And that language is familiar.
It's nearly identical to the language in a blessing given by Joseph Smith's own father, Joseph Smith Sr., just 1 year before the Book of Abraham translation began. That blessing, recorded by Oliver Cowdery, talks about seeking the right of the fathers, the authority of the holy priesthood, and being followers of righteousness.
So Abraham, the ancient patriarch, is speaking in the institutional jargon of the Mormon Church in Kirtland, Ohio in 1834.
It's the technical theological language of Joseph Smith's inner circle. It strongly suggests the author was drafting this narrative using the religious vocabulary that was most immediate and powerful to him, which wasn't ancient Egyptian, but the newly minted phrases of early Mormonism.
That's a direct link to the author's mind. Now, what about a major narrative element? The story of Abraham being sacrificed in a fiery furnace. Where does that come from?
Right, because that story is not in the Bible. Abraham 1 describes this dramatic scene where the Tetonians try to sacrifice Abraham for rejecting their idols.
So if it's not from the Bible, and as we've discussed, not from the papyrus, what's the source?
It's from a book on Joseph Smith's shelf, or at least a book he was very familiar with, the Adam Clark Bible Commentary.
It's a very popular commentary at the time.
Hugely popular. And what's critical is that we know Joseph Smith was using Adam Clark's commentary heavily just a few years earlier, around 1831, when he was working on his own revision of the Bible, the JST.
And what does Clark's commentary say?
Clark explicitly recounts this ancient tradition that Abraham was cast into a fiery furnace for rejecting idolatry. It's right there in the notes, which Smith would have been reading as he went through Genesis.
So the central dramatic event of the first chapter wasn't divinely revealed. It was likely pulled directly from a contemporary scholarly book that Joseph Smith was actively using for another project.
It seems to show a pattern of composition. He's drawing on available ideas, traditions, and speculations from his environment, and then weaving them into what he presents as an ancient text.
And this reliance on contemporary learning gets even more explicit with what might be the most definitive fingerprint of all, the impact of his 1836 Hebrew lessons.
This one is just, it's undeniable because of the timeline. The Book of Abraham was produced in two distinct phases.
Right, the first part in 1835.
Chapters 1 through 2, verse 18, and then there's a 7-year gap. The rest of it, chapters 3, 4, and 5, aren't produced until 1842.
And what happens right in the middle of that gap?
In 1836, Joseph Smith hires a professor, Joshua Sexsmith, and takes intensive Hebrew lessons.
So the question is, did this secular education in Hebrew affect a text he claimed was a translation from ancient Egyptian?
The answer is a resounding yes. It's a night and day difference. The later material, the 1842 section, is littered with Hebrew terms, Hebrew concepts, Hebrew-influenced theology, all of which is completely absent from the earlier 1835 section.
What's the biggest theological shift that comes directly from those lessons?
The creation account in chapters 4 and 5. It's the classic example. Suddenly, the text describes creation being performed by the gods, plural.
The plurality of gods.
This new doctrine, which was a huge shift in his theology, comes directly from what he learned about the Hebrew word Elohim.
Which he learned in his class is grammatically plural.
Exactly. Zexis taught him, Elohim literally means gods. At the same time, Joseph's theology about the Godhead was evolving away from traditional Trinity ideas. So he takes his new grammatical knowledge from his Hebrew class and writes it directly into Scripture. The Book of Abraham becomes the vehicle to reveal that the Bible was wrong and there really were multiple gods involved in creation.
That's stunning. The content of a supposed divine translation from Egyptian is directly dependent on the translator's recent secular education in Hebrew.
An ancient text should not pivot its core theology based on what its 19th century translator learned in a grammar class last year. It just shows the translation was limited by the translator's own knowledge.
And this continues with the astronomy, right? The cosmology in chapter 3, Kolob, Shinaha, all of that.
Yes. That complex system of stars and governing herbs. It doesn't match ancient Egyptian astronomy, and it certainly doesn't match modern science.
So where does it come from?
It looks a lot like the popular metaphysical and astronomical theories that were floating around in books that Joseph Smith owned. Works like Thomas Dick's Philosophy of a Future State from 1830.
And what were those books talking about?
They were speculating about things like a universe made of eternal, indestructible matter, about intelligences, about stars revolving around a central point, which they often called the throne of God. And the idea that time itself is relative, depending on your distance from that central point. All of these concepts are front and center in Abraham chapter 3.
And it even includes 19th century scientific errors.
It does. For example, the Book of Abraham suggests the sun gets its light from a higher source, from Kolob, that doesn't generate its own light. This was a common idea in the 1830s because no one knew about nuclear fusion yet. The source of the sun's power was a total mystery.
So the book's divine cosmology actually incorporates the scientific ignorance of its time.
Another fingerprint. The author was clearly limited by the scientific knowledge available in the 1830s.
The evidence is just so consistent. But we have to be rigorous. Let's look at the counterarguments, the so-called hits that defenders of the book bring up.
Right, the apologetic claims.
The first one is about human sacrifice. Apologists say the book is right to talk about human sacrifice in Chaldea, and that recent findings confirm people were executed for rejecting idols.
This is a classic case of playing with words. It's a confusion of terms. The ancient texts that apologists point to, as Dr. Rittner and others have shown, are talking about political executions, capital punishment.
So not religious sacrifice.
Not at all. They were state-sanctioned punishments for crimes like treason or trespassing in a temple. They were not religious human sacrifices on an altar to appease a god because someone refused to worship, which is the specific scenario of the Book of Abraham. They're conflating two very different things to force a connection that isn't there.
Okay, next up, Olishim. This is a big one. The book mentions a place called Olishim, and apologists found an ancient inscription that mentions a town called Olishim. They claim this is a bullseye.
This claim falls apart as soon as you look at a map. First, geography. The Book of Abraham is set in a southern Mesopotamian context. This town, Olishim, is thousands of miles away in northwestern Syria.
So it's in completely the wrong place.
Completely. Then there's the linguistics. The original word is Elysium. There's no sh sound in it. There's no O sound. The match just doesn't work phonetically.
So you have to ignore the location and the sound to make it fit.
You do. And even the main scholar who proposed this, John Gee, has admitted under questioning that the connection is just promising but not proven. It's a classic case of what critics call parallel mania, desperately looking for any possible connection, no matter how tenuous.
All right, what about Elkanah? The claim that Joseph Smith miraculously guessed the name of an idolatrous god. They even used Powerball odds for this one.
Ah, yes, the world's greatest guesser argument. This is just statistical nonsense. First of all, the name Elkanah isn't recognized by scholars as an ancient god's name. It's just the biblical name Elkanah, which Joseph Smith would have been very familiar with a minor change.
So he didn't pull it out of thin air?
Not at all. And second, the whole Powerball odds comparison is intellectually dishonest. It's what's known as the base rate fallacy. You can't just focus on the one supposed hit and ignore the mountains of misses.
All the other names and translations from the papyrus that were completely wrong.
Exactly. Joseph Smith produced thousands of translations and identifications. Almost all of them are demonstrably wrong. If you guess thousands of times, you're bound to get a few that seemed close by sheer chance. To celebrate one near miss while ignoring a 99% failure rate is not a serious argument.
It's creating a miracle out of a statistical inevitability.
Precisely.
Okay, one last one. The claim that a later Egyptian text was discovered that confirms details like Abraham teaching astronomy.
This is my favorite example of misdirection. When they say later Egyptian text, what they're actually talking about is a Coptic Christian text from about 400 AD.
400 years after Christ.
Yes, which is about 2,200 years after Abraham. So what does this text prove? It doesn't prove the Book of Abraham is ancient.
It proves that the traditions Joseph Smith used were floating around in late antiquity.
Exactly. It confirms our entire thesis. It shows the Book of Abraham is part of a long line of pseudepigrapha texts written much later and attributed to an ancient figure. By citing this Coptic text, apologists are accidentally admitting that the Book of Abraham is drawing on post-Abrahamic material.
So let's just step back and pull all of this together.
The consistency is what's so striking. It's not just one or two little problems. It's a cascade. We have geopolitical errors like Ur of the Chaldees. We have linguistic errors like Potiphar. We have 19th century social issues like the Curse of Ham.
And direct reliance on 19th century sources.
Yeah.
The King James Bible, the Adam Clark commentary.
And his own Hebrew lessons from 1836, directly changing the theology of the book in 1842.
If a text is truly an ancient divine translation, it shouldn't be so completely trapped by the limitations of its 19th century author's knowledge. The scholarly conclusion seems unavoidable.
It's that the Book of Abraham is a classic piece of pseudepigrapha, a work written in a later time, but attributed to a famous ancient figure, like Abraham or Moses, to give it authority. Joseph Smith was simply engaging in an ancient practice using modern 19th century tools.
The amount of special pleading you have to do to believe the traditional story is just immense. You have to believe God intentionally revealed a text filled with the scientific and historical errors of the 1830s.
And that he did so while claiming it was a literal record penned by Abraham himself. It just stretches credibility to the breaking point. The text itself tells you, with remarkable clarity, who wrote it and when.
And that has enormous implications for how we view Joseph Smith's other works.
Huge implications.
Which brings us to our final thought for you, the listener, to consider. We've shown, I think, pretty clearly from the internal evidence that Joseph Smith's ability to translate was tied directly to his own contemporary knowledge, his school lessons, the books he was reading, the culture around him.
So if the Book of Abraham, a document where we actually have some of the source material and can verify the context, if that book is so clearly a 19th century product filled with verifiable errors and anachronisms, then what does that pattern of dependence on his own time tell you about the reliability of his other major translation projects, like the Book of Mormon, for which we have no source text to check against at all? That is a fundamental question of credibility, and it's a question only you can answer for yourself.